too disempowered. There's not just the flat world and the unflat world. Many people live in the twilight zone between the two. Among these are the people I call the too disempowered. They are healthy people who live in countries with significant areas that have been flattened, but who don't have the tools or the skills or the infrastructure to participate in any meaningful or sustained way. Being flat is good, but full of pressure. Being unflat is awful and full of pain. But being half flat has its own special anxiety. We saw how big and how angry this group can be in the spring of 2004 Indian national elections, in which the ruling BJP was surprisingly tossed out of office, despite having overseen a surge in India's growth rate, largely because of the discontent of rural Indian voters with the slow pace of globalization outside the giant cities. These rural voters, peasants and farmers, who form the bulk of India's population, just had to spend a day in any nearby big city to see the benefits of the flat world. The cars, the houses, the educational opportunities. At the same time, these rural Indians understood at gut level exactly why it was not happening for them. Because local governments in India have become so eaten away by corruption and mismanagement that they cannot deliver to the poor the schools and infrastructure they need to get a fair share of the pie. The Congress Party got the message, which was why as soon as it took office, it chose as its prime minister not some anti-globalizer, but Manmohan Singh, the former Indian finance minister, who in 1991 first opened the Indian economy to globalization, placing an emphasis on exports and trade and reform wholesale. And Singh, in turn, pledged himself to vastly increase government investments in rural infrastructure and to bring more reform retail to rural government. How can outsiders collaborate in this process? I think, first and foremost, they can redefine the meaning of global populism. If populists really want to help the rural poor, the way to do it is not by burning down McDonald's and shutting down the IMF and trying to put up protectionist barriers that will unflatten the world. That will help the rural poor not one iota. It has to be by refocusing the energies of the global populist movement on how to improve local government, infrastructure, and education in places like rural India and China, so the populations there can acquire the tools to collaborate and participate in the flat world. The global populist movement, better known as the anti-globalization movement, has a great deal of energy, but up to now, it has been too divided and confused to effectively help the poor in any meaningful or sustained manner. It needs a policy lobotomy. Ramesh Ramanathan, the Indian-born former Citibank executive who returned to India to lead an NGO called Janagraha, dedicated to improving local governance, is precisely the kind of new populist I have in mind. In India, he said, clients of public education are sending a signal about the quality of service delivery. Whoever can afford to opt out does so. The same goes for healthcare. Given the escalating costs of healthcare, if we had a solid public healthcare system, most citizens would opt to use it, not just the poor. Ditto for roads, highways, water supply, sanitation, registration of births and deaths, crematoria, driver's licenses, and so on. Wherever the government provides these services, it should be for the benefit of all citizens. But, in fact, in some of these, like water supply and sanitation, the poor are actually not even getting the same basic services as the middle class and the rich. The challenge here is therefore universal access. Getting NGOs that can collaborate on the local level to ensure that the poor get the infrastructure and the budgets to which they are entitled could have a major impact on poverty alleviation. What the world doesn't need now is for the anti-globalization movement to go away. We just need it to grow up. This movement had a lot of energy and a lot of mobilizing capacity. What it lacked was a coherent agenda for assisting the poor by collaborating with them in a way that could actually help them. The activist groups that are helping alleviate poverty the most are those working at the local village level in places like rural India, Africa, and China to spotlight and fight corruption and to promote accountability, transparency, education, and property rights. It may not be as sexy as protesting against world leaders in the streets of Washington and Genoa and getting lots of attention on CNN, but it is a lot more important. Just ask any Indian villager. Too frustrated. One of the unintended consequences of the flat world is that it puts different societies and cultures in much greater direct contact with one another. Some cultures thrive on the sudden opportunities for collaboration that this global intimacy makes possible. Others are threatened, frustrated, and even humiliated by this close contact, which, among other things, makes it very easy for people to see where they stand in the world vis-a-vis everyone else. All of this helps to explain the emergence of one of the most dangerous unflattening forces today, the suicide bombers of Al-Qaeda and the other Islamist terror organizations, who are coming out of the Muslim world and Muslim communities in Europe. The Arab Muslim world is a vast, diverse civilization, encompassing over 1 billion people and stretching from Morocco to Indonesia and from Nigeria all the way to the suburbs of London. It is very dangerous to generalize about such a complex religious community, made up of so many different ethnicities and nationalities. But one need only look at the headlines in any day's newspaper to appreciate that a lot of anger and frustration seems to be bubbling over from the Muslim world in general, and from the Arab Muslim world in particular, where many young people seem to be agitated by a combination of issues. One of the most obvious is the festering Arab-Israeli conflict and the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land and East Jerusalem, a grievance which has a powerful emotional hold on the Arab-Muslim imagination and has long soured relations with America and the West. But this is not the only reason for the brewing anger in these communities. This anger also has to do with the frustration of Arabs and Muslims at having to live, in many, many cases, under authoritarian governments, which not only deprive their people of a voice in their own future, but have deprived tens of millions of young people in particular of opportunities to achieve their full potential through good jobs and modern schools. The fact that the flat world enables people to so easily compare their circumstances with others only sharpens their frustrations. Some of these Arab-Muslim young men and women have chosen to emigrate in order to find opportunities in the West. Unfortunately, though, these progressive young people are not the ones defining the relationship between the Arab-Muslim community and the world at large today. Increasingly, that relationship is being dominated by and defined by religious militants and extremists who give vent to the frustrations in that part of the world by simply lashing out. The question that I want to explore in this section is this: what produced this violent Islamist fringe, and why has it found so much passive support in the Arab Muslim world today? Even though I am convinced the vast majority there do not share the violent agenda of these groups or their apocalyptic visions. The question is relevant to a book about the flat world for a very simple reason. Should there be another attack on the United States of the magnitude of 9/11 or worse, walls would go up everywhere and the flattening of the world would be set back for a long, long time. That, of course, is precisely what the Islamists want. When Muslim radicals and fundamentalists look at the West, they see only the openness that makes us, in their eyes, decadent and promiscuous. They see only the openness that has produced Britney Spears and Janet Jackson. They do not see and do not want to see the openness, the freedom of thought and inquiry that has made us powerful. The openness that has produced Bill Gates and Sally Ride. They deliberately define it all as decadence. Because if openness, women's empowerment, and freedom of thought and inquiry are the real sources of the West's economic strength, then the Arab Muslim world would have to change. And the fundamentalists and extremists do not want to change. To beat back the threat of openness, the Muslim extremists have, quite deliberately, chosen to attack the very thing that keeps open societies open, innovating, and flattening. And that is trust. When terrorists take instruments from our daily lives, the car, the airplane, the tennis shoe, the cell phone, and turn them into weapons of indiscriminate violence, they reduce trust. Without trust, there is no open society, because there are not enough police to patrol every opening in an open society. Without trust, there can also be no flat world. Because it is trust that allows us to take down walls, remove barriers, and eliminate friction at borders. The founders of Al-Qaeda are not religious fundamentalists per se. They are a political phenomenon more than a religious one. I like to call them Islamo-Leninists. I use the term Leninists to convey the utopian totalitarian vision of Al-Qaeda as well as its self-image. As Al-Qaeda's chief ideologist, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has put it, Al-Qaeda is the ideological vanguard whose attacks on the United States and other Western targets are designed to mobilize and energize the Muslim masses to rise up against their own corrupt rulers, who are propped up by America. They vow to establish an Islamic state across the same territory that Islam ruled over at its height, led by a caliph, a supreme religious political leader who would unite all the Muslim peoples into a single community. Islamo-Leninism, in many ways, emerged from the same historical context as the radical European ideologies of the 19th and 20th centuries. Fascism and Marxist-Leninism grew out of the rapid industrialization and modernization of Germany and Central Europe, where communities living in tightly bonded villages and extended families suddenly got shattered, and the sons and fathers went off to the urban areas to work for big industrial companies. In this age of transitions, young men in particular lost a sense of identity, rootedness, and personal dignity that had been provided by traditional social structures. In that vacuum, along came Hitler, Lenin, and Mussolini, who told these young men that they had an answer for their feelings of dislocation and humiliation. You may not be in the village or small town anymore, but you are still proud, dignified members of a larger community, the working class or the Aryan nation. Bin Laden offered the same sort of ideological response for young Arabs and Muslims. The first person to recognize the Islamo-Leninist character of these 9/11 hijackers, that they were not fundamentalists but adherents of an extreme, violent political cult, was Adrian Karatnitsky, the president of Freedom House. In a November 5, 2001 article in the National Review, titled Under Our Very Noses, Karatnitsky makes the following argument. The key hijackers were well-educated children of privilege. None of them suffered first-hand economic privation or political oppression, and none of them seemed to have been raised in a particularly fundamentalist household. Indeed, the top 9/11 operatives and pilots, like Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, who shared an apartment in Hamburg, where they both attended the Technical University of Hamburg-Harburg, all seemed to have been recruited to Al-Qaeda through cells and prayer groups. After they moved to Europe. None of these plotters was recruited in the Middle East and then planted in Europe years in advance by Bin Laden, notes Karatnitsky. To the contrary, virtually all of them seem to have lived in Europe on their own, grown alienated from the European society around them, gravitated to a local prayer group or mosque to find warmth and solidarity, undergone a born-again conversion, gotten radicalized by Islamist elements, gone off for training in Afghanistan, and presto, a terrorist was born. Unfortunately, Bin Laden and his colleagues have found it all too easy to enlist recruits in the Arab Muslim world. I think this has to do in part with the state of half-flatness that many Arab Muslim young people are living in, particularly those in Europe. They have been raised to believe that Islam is the most perfect and complete expression of God's monotheistic message, and that the Prophet Muhammad is God's last and most perfect messenger. This is not a criticism. This is Islam's self-identity. Yet, in a flat world, these youth, particularly those living in Europe, can and do look around and see that the Arab Muslim world, in too many cases, has fallen behind the rest of the planet. It is not living as prosperously or as democratically as other civilizations. How can that be? These young Arabs and Muslims must ask themselves. If we have the superior faith, and if our faith is all-encompassing of religion, politics, and economics, why are others living so much better? This is a source of real cognitive dissonance for many Arab Muslim youth, the sort of dissonance and loss of self-esteem that sparks rage and leads some of them to join violent groups and lash out at the world. Indeed, talk to young Arabs and Muslims anywhere, and this cognitive dissonance and the word humiliation always come up very quickly in conversation. Humiliation is the most underestimated force in international relations and in human relations. It is when people or nations are humiliated that they really lash out and engage in extreme violence. When you take the economic and political backwardness of much of the Arab Muslim world today, add its past grandeur and self-image of religious superiority, and combine it with the discrimination and alienation these Arab Muslim males face when they leave home and move to Europe, or when they grow up in Europe, you have one powerful cocktail of rage. This frustration and humiliation is not confined to the Islamist fringes. The reason why the Islamo-Leninists have become the most energized and pronounced opponents of globalization / Americanization and the biggest threat to the flattening of the world today is not simply their extraordinary violence, but also because they enjoy some passive support around the Arab Muslim world. In part, this is because most governments in the Arab Muslim world have refused to take on these radicals in a war of ideas. While Arab regimes have been very active in jailing their Islamo-Leninists when they can find and arrest them, they have been very passive in countering them with a modern progressive interpretation of Islam. This is because almost all of these Arab Muslim leaders are illegitimate themselves. Having come to power by force, they have no credibility as carriers of a moderate progressive Islam, and they always feel vulnerable to hardline Muslim preachers who denounce them for not being good Muslims. So instead of taking on the Muslim radicals, the Arab regimes either throw them in jail or try to buy them off. This leaves a terrible spiritual and political void. But the other reason for the passive support that the Islamo-Leninists enjoy, and the fact that they are able to raise so much money through charities and mosques in the Arab Muslim world, is that too many good, decent people there feel the same frustration and tinge of humiliation that many of their most enraged youth do. And there is a certain respect for the way these violent youth have been ready to stand up to the world and to their own leaders and defend the honor of their civilization. When I visited Qatar a few months after 9/11, a friend of mine there, a sweet, thoughtful, liberal person who works for the Qatari government, confided to me something in a whisper that was deeply troubling to him. "My 11-year-old son thinks Bin Laden is a good man." Most middle-class Arabs and Muslims, I am convinced, were not celebrating the death of 3,000 innocent Americans on 9/11. I know my Arab and Muslim friends were not. But many Arabs and Muslims were celebrating the idea of putting a fist in America's face, and they were quietly applauding the men who did it. They were happy to see someone humiliating the people and the country that they felt was humiliating them and supporting what they saw as injustice in their world, whether it is America's backing of Arab kings and dictators who export oil to it, or America's backing of Israel, whether it does the right things or the wrong things. Germany was humiliated after World War I, but it had the modern economic foundations to produce a state response to that humiliation, in the form of the Third Reich. The Arab world, by contrast, could not produce a state response to its humiliation. Instead, it has rattled the world stage in the last 50 years with two larger-than-life figures, rather than states, noted political theorist Yaron Ezrahi. One was the Saudi oil minister Ahmed Zaki Yamani, and the other was Osama bin Laden. What makes Yamanism and bin Ladenism so unfortunate as strategies for Arab influence in the world is that they ignore the examples within Arab culture and civilization, when it was at its height, of discipline, hard work, knowledge, achievement, scientific inquiry, and pluralism. The Arab Muslim peoples have an incredibly rich cultural tradition and civilization, with long periods of success and innovation to draw on for inspiration and example for their young people. They have all the resources necessary for modernization in their own cultural terms, if they want to summon them. Unfortunately, there is huge resistance to such modernization from the authoritarian and religiously obscurantist forces within the Arab Muslim world. That is why this part of the world will be liberated and feel truly empowered only if it goes through its own war of ideas, and the moderates there win. The best thing outsiders can do for the Arab Muslim world today is try to collaborate with its progressive forces in every way possible, from trying to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict to stabilizing Iraq to signing free trade agreements with as many Arab countries as possible so as to foster a similar war of ideas within their civilization. There is no other way. Otherwise, this part of the world has the potential to be a huge unflattening force. We have to wish the good people there well, but the battle will be won for them to fight and to win. No one can do it for them.
Globalization of the local. The Cultural Revolution is about to begin. My 1999 book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, attempted to describe the forces that were globalizing the world at the end of the 20th century and their effects on economics, politics, geopolitics, environment, and culture. After the first edition of The World is Flat first came out, several readers complained to me that I had not followed up on the cultural part of my argument in The Lexus and the Olive Tree. I had made no mention of how this new, flattening era of globalization at the dawn of the 21st century was affecting culture around the world. I acknowledged this and explained that it was simply a matter of not having had enough time to think through that issue. This updated edition of the book has given me a chance to do just that, and I'm glad it has, because the flattening of the world is having surprising, important, and paradoxical effects on culture around the world. As the flattening phase of globalization began to gain momentum following the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was a considerable and justifiable worry around the world that globalization means Americanization. This worry was not unreasonable, because it was primarily American-based manufacturers and service providers, American brands and American movie makers, American singers and American entertainers, American clothing designers, and American fast food chains who were in the best position to take advantage of the falling of the walls and the flattening of the world. They were the first out of the gates, and it seemed inevitable and unstoppable that they would take advantage of the flat world to homogenize culture. If you were from another culture, no matter how robust and vibrant your distinctive dress, language, food, or music, you had to worry that you could be easily steamrolled. In the constant struggle between the homogenizing and particularizing forces of globalization, it seemed like the homogenizing, Americanizing forces were destined to triumph. Globalization would have an American face, an American look, and an American taste. This naturally triggered a backlash against globalization as a form of American cultural imperialism. Many people around the world argued that unless we took serious steps to strengthen cultures and protect the environment, the juggernaut of globalization as Americanization could, in just a few decades, wipe out the cultural, ecological, and zoological diversity that took millions of years of human, plant, and animal evolution to produce. There is reason to hope that the flattening of the world will not necessarily pave the way for a red, white, and blue cultural homogenization. Indeed, what is becoming clear is that the Flat World Platform, while it has the potential to homogenize cultures, also has, I would argue, an even more powerful potential to nourish diversity to a degree that the world has never seen before. Why? Primarily because of uploading. Uploading makes possible the globalization of the local. The fact that so many people worldwide now have the tools to create and upload their own content, their own news reports, their own opinions, their own music, their own videos, their own photos, their own software, their own browsers, their own encyclopedias, their own dictionaries. This is a very powerful force for the preservation and enhancement of cultural autonomy and particularity. The Flat World Platform enables you to take your own local culture, art, songs, literature, painting, film, and upload it to the world. It means you aren't stuck downloading Mickey Mouse and McDonald's. No, no, no. You can now write your own song, create a podcast version in any language you like, and share it with the world on some podcast site. And if it is popular, it will spread. You can now make your own home video with a cheap webcam and Microsoft Movie Maker that comes bundled with your software and upload that as well. The most popular food in the world is not the Big Mac, it's pizza. And what is pizza? It is just a piece of flat dough that every culture puts its own distinctive foods and flavors on. So Japan has sushi pizza, and Bangkok has Thai pizza, and Lebanon has meze pizza. The Flat World Platform is just like that pizza dough. It allows every culture to season and flavor it as they like, and you are going to see them do that more now than ever. At the same time, the fact that people in emerging nations like India will be able to innovate without having to emigrate means that local cultures have a much better chance of being preserved. A young Indian engineer no longer has to stand in line outside the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi and pray to win the lottery and secure a visa to America so that he or she can move to frigid Minnesota and give up his or her native dress, native cuisine, native music, and extended family, all the things that make up a native culture, just to get a decent engineering job at 3M. That is a very good thing for the preservation of Indian local culture. Cultures are nested in environments, and to the extent that more people can now not only survive, but even thrive by staying home in their native region, in their own environment, has got to be a net plus for the forces of cultural diversity versus the forces of homogeneity. Moreover, even those individuals who have had to uproot themselves from developing countries to go west, to Europe or America in particular, have been able to take advantage of the flattening of the world to hold on to many aspects of their local culture, even if they are living in the midst of a different one thousands of miles away. Thanks to their ability to read their local newspapers online, to communicate with family and friends by phone for almost nothing using voice over the internet technology, to watch daily news from Cairo or Calcutta, in Arabic and Hindi, thanks to internet or satellite TV, the forces of particularization now seem to be as strong as the forces of homogenization. Of course, Americanization via globalization is still a very powerful force. One should never underestimate it. But somehow, more than a decade after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it no longer seems inevitable that everyone is going to look, speak, sing, dance, and think like an American because of globalization. As it happens, globalization of the local is an expression I first saw used by an Indian-born expert on globalization and cultural identity, Indrajit Banerjee, the Secretary General of the Asian Media Information and Communication Center, AMIC. In an interview with Felix So of the Straits Times of Singapore, September 11, 2005, Banerjee explained that he coined the term to describe the phenomenon that allows diaspora communities around the world to use today's global media networks to cling to their local mores, news, traditions, and friends, no matter where they are living. As So put it in the introduction to his interview with Banerjee, globalization of the local is globalization in reverse. Instead of global media enveloping Asia, the region's local media are going global. This phenomenon of the globalization of the local is being driven by the demand for local news and information from Asia's diasporas, notably the millions of Chinese and Indian emigres now living in all parts of the world. Banerjee, who has a PhD in communications from the Sorbonne in Paris, sees this from his perch in Singapore, where he teaches at a university. One would think that globalization in Asia would mean going English, but that's not the case, he said in the interview with the Straits Times. The diasporic market means you can have international newspapers, international TV and radio channels, which are completely based on local languages. This is what I call the globalization of the local. It is not the global which comes and envelops us. It is the local which goes global. Today, Britain and the United States have television channels where the programming is all in Chinese, Spanish, Arabic, or Japanese. If you have populations spread all over the world, then you can use effectively the satellite platforms to broadcast to pockets all over the world, added Banerjee. If you put these pockets together, they become a huge global market. So pointed out that ZTV, the biggest Indian entertainment network, had blazed a trail for other Indian TV channels to go regional in Asia. Said Banerjee, ZTV has a very clear Indian market. It is the Indian diaspora. Its programming is in Hindi. For ZTV, competition is not really an issue. It doesn't want to capture the other language audiences. He added, also, in the near future, Asia will be a major producer of media content, which is a very positive development. For a long time, Asia was a receiver of content from the West. Now, because we're coming of age and becoming mature, our media experiences are substantial. This, together with the rich culture and heritage of Asia, presents the region with tremendous potential to be a content trading hub. India has one of the world's biggest film industries. It is producing a lot of television content. South Korea and Japan are very strong in animation. My belief is that the global is going to be interesting only if it is a range of the local. The whole diversity of local experiences and local content is present, rather than one content producer, one language, one cultural perspective, and one ideology dominating the world. India, for instance, has exploded recently as a platform for the outsourcing of game designs and cartoon animation. I was struck by something the head of one of these companies said to me when I visited. Ashish Kulkarni, COO of Jadoo Works in Bangalore, explained that India had an abundance of traditional artists who were able to make the transition easily to computerized digital painting. Many of these artists are the children of Hindu temple sculptors and painters. We train them to transform their traditional skills to animation in a digital format, said Kulkarni. But to keep up their traditional Indian painting skills, Jadoo Works also had a room set aside where artists could retreat to indulge in their native artistry, because the two skills reinforce each other. Companies like Jadoo Works come and go with the demands of the global market and who can offer the best, cheapest artists at any given time. But before the world got flat, India had virtually no companies doing this business at all. Now, a new generation of Indian artists will at least have a chance to maintain or advance their skills rather than drive taxis to earn a living. We now tell the parents, if your kids are doing well in drawing in seventh grade, you must think of making a career in animation, said Kulkarni. That was difficult 5 years back, but today, because of more exposure, we can get people to think they can transform their skills that their fathers had, and thereby hold on to them. I interviewed Deepak Ganguly, a slender 28-year-old computer artist who was then working at Jadoo Works.
My parents are artists, and my mother is a sculptor at home, he explained. My father was a carpet designer. He made designs for Indian carpets. I had a knack for drawing, because I was brought up in this kind of climate, so I came into this field. When I started this animation career at the time, 3D computers for drawing were not here in India. So I did a course in 2D classical animation, and I was a 2D animator. When this 3D boom happened in India in the past couple years, I decided to jump. I was working at a small studio in Delhi. We used to watch movies and Star Wars and their computer-generated things. Then I got the chance to learn that skill. Globalization, said Ganguly, was enabling him to take his skills and now sell them all over the world. With all the easy sharing in the electronic media, he said, we can get the work here easier and we can send our skills over there easier. To listen to some of the critics, though, you would think that globalization was only about the spread of crass capitalism, global brands, fast food and consumer values, all crowding out warm, cozy, thriving local communities, industries, and cultures. There is no question that the forces of globalization do some or all of these things in many places, on many days. But globalization is not simply about the spread of capitalism or markets or enhanced trade. It is not an exclusively economic phenomenon, and its impact is not exclusively economic. It is a much broader, deeper, and more complex phenomenon involving new forms of communication and innovation. The flattening of the world is about the creation of a global platform for multiple forms of sharing work, knowledge, and entertainment. Worrying about the pulverizing effects of globalization is very legitimate, indeed very important, but ignoring its ability to also empower individuals and enrich our cultural cornucopia is to miss its potentially positive effects on human freedom and culture. My point here is not that the flattening of the world will always enrich and preserve culture. My point is that it doesn't always destroy culture either, which is the message you hear if you listen only to the globalization critics. The iron law of globalization is very simple. If you think it is all good, or if you think it is all bad, you don't get it. Globalization has empowering and disempowering, homogenizing and particularizing, democratizing and authoritarian tendencies all built into it. It is about the global market, but it is also about the internet and Google. One should have no doubt, I certainly don't, that the flat world empowers the forces of darkness as well as the forces of light. You can upload homemade pornography, homegrown racism, lies, conspiracy theories, and just plain hokum, and spread them easier, faster, and farther on the flat world platform as well. The New York Times, on December 19, 2005, ran a chilling front-page story about a teenage boy, Justin Berry, who was drawn into performing in front of a webcam, undressing, showering, masturbating, and even having sex for an audience of more than 1,500 people who paid him, over the years, hundreds of thousands of dollars. What is really ironic is that they often paid him by using PayPal.com, the online payment system owned by eBay to make it easy for individuals to buy and sell on its auction site. For all these reasons, our job is not to trash this platform, but to get the best out of it and to prevent the worst. The kind of globalization we are talking about now, with the internet and the flattening of the world, is a different kind of globalization than the one that is in the minds of the people who have been criticizing globalization, remarked Israeli political theorist Yaron Israhi. It has different opportunities and dangers. In cultural terms, the globalization of the local is allowing a local group of human rights supporters to become part of an international community and feel that solidarity, and the same with environmentalists. And the same, unfortunately, is true with neo-Nazis and Al-Qaeda sympathizers. Wherever human beings have the freedom to create communities, they can create progressive or criminal ones. But the fact is that the internet has magnified the capacity of individuals to generate their own stories and inscribe themselves on the world both as individuals and part of communities. Should we be against that? Of course not.
As of the printing of this book, Google was available in 116 different languages, from Arabic to Zulu to several versions of Chinese.
The more people can easily inform themselves in their own languages, the more likely those languages and texts are to survive, and the more likely others will write in them and not feel compelled to switch to English. Search is one of the 10 flatteners, and the globalization of the local will be steadily enhanced as search engines gradually spread to every corner of the flat world. In fairness to globalization's critics, it has to be noted that homogenization is not the only or maybe even the most serious threat to global cultures. Critics could argue, notes Ezrahi, that a flat world produces a flat culture, that diversity is not a guarantee of depth and excellence. It might be argued that uploading, unconstrained now by quality control filters, weakens our ability to discriminate between low and high quality culture and encourages the turning of rich cultures into a bazaar of diverse cultural fragments. This line of criticism is vulnerable to the charges of elitism and the tendency to underestimate the quality, creativity, and the significance of low or popular culture, noted Ezrahi, but it is worth keeping an eye on. One can see all of these issues arising with the emergence of podcasting, a whole new tool for globalizing the local. I got a glimpse into this phenomenon in October 2005 when I visited a small apartment in suburban Shanghai that is home to China's leading podcasting website, Tudou.com. We already have 13,000 channels on our site, and about 5,000 of them are updated regularly, explained Gary Wang, 32, the Fuzhou-born and U.S. and French-educated Chinese engineer who founded Tudou, which means potato in Chinese. Any Chinese can create his or her own channel of video or audio content on Tudou, and other individuals sign up to get the content on that channel each time new material is uploaded. For now, the service is free. Eventually, Tudou will charge a monthly subscription. I want to create hundreds of thousands of different channels, maintained by just average people, where other people can access them and download the material, added Wang. And he will, because the ease of uploading and podcasting means there are almost no barriers to entry, as long as you have a computer, a camera, and a microphone. There are still political limits on what you can say from China, but who knows how long those limits will be sustainable. Tudou.com censors porn and anything that violates Chinese law or directly threatens the communist government. Tudou's most popular podcast, when I visited in October 2005, was a video of two 20-year-old Chinese women lip-syncing a popular Cantonese rock tune. They got bored, explained Wang, so they went out and bought their own webcam, which can be found in Shanghai for the equivalent of $6, used Microsoft Movie Maker, software that comes bundled with Windows XP, made their own 3-minute MTV-like podcast, and uploaded it onto Tudou.com. It was viewed 75,000 times in the first 3 months. It took them 1 hour to make and 15 minutes to edit, said Wang. The girls, who call themselves The Beans, now have their own internet fan club. Another favorite is a podcast by two Chinese architecture students wearing Houston Rockets jerseys, the team of Chinese-born NBA star Yao Ming, and lip-syncing a Backstreet Boys tune. A slideshow on life in Shenzhen had been viewed 16,000 times, prompting all sorts of accompanying commentary from viewers. The second highest viewed podcast when I visited was a concert by an underground rock band at a Shanghai bar. Tudou's goal, said Wang, will be to connect Chinese people to their tastes and to their potential collaborators. We will have a huge content database and we will share the revenue with content providers. Wang added, we created this platform for free participation and people just come in. With all kinds of tools becoming cheaper and cheaper, the creative part of people will naturally grow and explode. Yes, I know, I am a little ahead of myself. Very few Chinese have ever even seen an iPod, so most of the podcasting that does exist here is created and viewed or heard on PCs. Once the price of an iPod, music or video, comes down, though, there will be a huge podcast market here. Many of the current podcasts are junk, but the quality, too, will surely improve. The ease of podcasting will force competition and experimentation. Wang first heard of podcasting only in 2004. Some 13 months later, he had the most popular podcasting site in China, with 100,000 registered users, 8 employees, 40 volunteers, and a U.S. venture capital backer. News of his site was spread for free by Chinese bloggers. The office he was using when I visited rents for $500 a month, and some of his employees also slept there. Almost all the software that runs Todo.com is from free, open-source material on the web, an Apache web server, free BSD, a free Unix operating system, MySQL, a free database system, and PHP, free programming language. Wang wrote the algorithms that run Todo.com himself. Comparing China to America and Europe, where he studied, Wang said, "With the same amount of money, I can do 10 times more here. I can live on $1,000 a month in Shanghai and have the latest technology in all these servers. Anything you can find in the U.S. is here." In China, the combination of low costs and lowered barriers is making the process of creating cultural content cheaper and, as a result, more popular. That's why I am confident this flattening phase of globalization is not going to mean more Americanization, but more globalization of local cultures, art forms, styles, recipes, literature, and opinions. More and more local content made global. We have different songs than Americans, and we want to express different things, but the desire is the same, said Wang. We all want to be seen and heard and be able to create stuff we like and share it. People from all over the world will draw knowledge and inspiration from the same technology platform, but different cultures will flourish on it. It is the same soil, but different trees will grow. And you thought the Cultural Revolution was over. Sorry, it's just beginning. Only China's newest Cultural Revolution is going to be driven this time from the bottom up, thanks to the Flat World platform, by podcasters with Apple's little white iPods, not from the top down by Maoists with little red books. In The Lexus and the Olive Tree, I argued that to the extent that countries tied their economies and futures to global integration and trade, it would act as a restraint on going to war with their neighbors. I first started thinking about this in the late 1990s when, during my travels, I noticed that no two countries that both had McDonald's had ever fought a war against each other since each got its McDonald's. After confirming this with McDonald's, I offered what I called the Golden Arches Theory of Conflict Prevention. The Golden Arches Theory stipulated that when a country reached the level of economic development where it had a middle class big enough to support a network of McDonald's, it became a McDonald's country. And people in McDonald's countries didn't like to fight wars anymore. They preferred to wait in line for burgers. While this was offered slightly tongue-in-cheek, the serious point I was trying to make was that as countries got woven into the fabric of global trade and rising living standards, which having a network of McDonald's franchises had come to symbolize, the cost of war for victor and vanquished became prohibitively high. This McDonald's theory has held up pretty well, but now that almost every country has acquired a McDonald's, except the worst rogues like North Korea, Iran, and Iraq under Saddam Hussein, it seemed to me that this theory needed updating for the flat world. In that spirit, and again with tongue slightly in cheek, I offer the Dell theory of conflict prevention, the essence of which is that the advent and spread of just-in-time global supply chains in the flat world are an even greater restraint on geopolitical adventurism than the more general rising standard of living that McDonald's symbolized. The Dell theory stipulates,
No two countries that are both part of a major global supply chain, like Dell's, will ever fight a war against each other as long as they are both part of the same global supply chain. Because people embedded in major global supply chains don't want to fight old-time wars anymore. They want to make just-in-time deliveries of goods and services and enjoy the rising standards of living that come with that. One of the people with the best feel for the logic behind this theory is Michael Dell, the founder and chairman of Dell. "These countries understand the risk premium that they have," said Dell of the countries in his Asian supply chain. "They are pretty careful to protect the equity that they have built up, or tell us why we should not worry about their doing anything adventurous. My belief, after visiting China, is that the change that has occurred there is in the best interest of the world and China. Once people get a taste for whatever you want to call it, economic independence, a better lifestyle, and a better life for their child or children, they grab onto that and don't want to give it up. Any sort of war or prolonged political upheaval in East Asia or China would have a massive chilling effect on the investment there and on all the progress that has been made there," said Dell, who added that he believes the governments in that part of the world understand this very clearly. "We certainly make clear to them that stability is important to us. Right now, it is not a day-to-day worry for us. I believe that as time and progress go on there, the chance for a really disruptive event goes down exponentially. I don't think our industry gets enough credit for the good we are doing in these areas. If you are making money and being productive and raising your standard of living, you're not sitting around thinking, 'Who did this to us?' or 'Why is our life so bad?'" There is a lot of truth to this. Countries whose workers and industries are woven into a major global supply chain know that they cannot take an hour, a week, or a month off for war without disrupting industries and economies around the world and thereby risking the loss of their place in that supply chain for a long time, which could be extremely costly. For a country with no natural resources, being part of a global supply chain is like striking oil that never runs out. And therefore, getting dropped from such a chain because you start a war is like having your oil wells go dry or having someone pour cement down them. They will not come back anytime soon. "You are going to pay for it really dearly," said Glenn E. Nayland, Senior Vice President for Worldwide Procurement at Dell, when I asked him what would happen to a major supply chain member in Asia that decided to start fighting with its neighbor and disrupt the supply chain. "It will not only bring you to your knees today, but you will pay for a long time, because you just won't have any credibility if you demonstrate you are going to go off the political deep end. And China is just now starting to develop a level of credibility in the business community that it is creating a business environment you can prosper in, with transparent and consistent rules." Nayland said that suppliers regularly ask him whether he is worried about China and Taiwan, which have threatened to go to war at several points in the past half century, but his standard response is that he cannot imagine them doing anything more than flexing muscles with each other. Nayland said that he can tell in his conversations and dealings with companies and governments in the Dell supply chain, particularly the Chinese, that they recognize the opportunity and are really hungry to participate in the same things they have seen other countries in Asia do. They know there is a big economic pot at the end of the rainbow, and they are really after it. "We will spend about $35 billion producing parts this year, and 30% of that is in China." "If you follow the evolution of supply chains," added Nayland, "you see the prosperity and stability they promoted first in Japan, and then in Korea and Taiwan, and now in Malaysia, Singapore, the Philippines, Thailand, and Indonesia. Once countries get embedded in these global supply chains, they feel part of something much bigger than their own businesses," he said. Osamu Watanabe, the CEO of the Japan External Trade Organization, JETRO, was explaining to me one afternoon in Tokyo how Japanese companies were moving vast amounts of low and middle-range technical work and manufacturing to China, doing the basic fabrication there, and then bringing it back to Japan for final assembly. Japan was doing this despite a bitter legacy of mistrust between the two countries, which was intensified by the Japanese invasion of China in the last century. Historically, he noted, a strong Japan and a strong China have had a hard time coexisting. But not today, at least not for the moment. Why not? I asked. The reason you can have a strong Japan and a strong China at the same time, he said, is because of the supply chain. It is a win-win for both. The Dell theory had its first real test in December 2004 when Taiwan held parliamentary elections. President Chen's pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party was expected to win the legislative runoff over the main opposition Nationalist Party, which favored closer ties with Beijing. Chen framed the election as a popular referendum on his proposal to write a new constitution that would formally enshrine Taiwan's independence, ending the purposely ambiguous status quo. Had Chen won and moved ahead on his agenda to make Taiwan its own motherland, as opposed to maintaining the status quo fiction that it is a province of the mainland, it could have led to a Chinese military assault on Taiwan. Everyone in the region was holding his or her breath. And what happened? Motherboards won over motherland. A majority of Taiwanese voted against the pro-independence governing party legislative candidates, ensuring that the DPP would not have a majority in parliament. I believe the message Taiwanese voters were sending was not that they never want Taiwan to be independent. It was that they do not want to upset the status quo right now, which has been so beneficial to so many Taiwanese. The voters seemed to understand clearly how interwoven they had become with the mainland, and they wisely opted to maintain their de facto independence rather than force de jure independence, which might have triggered a Chinese invasion and a very uncertain future. Warning. What I said when I put forth the McDonald's theory, I would repeat even more strenuously with the Dell theory. It does not make wars obsolete, and it does not guarantee that governments will not engage in wars of choice, even governments that are part of major supply chains. To suggest so would be naive. It guarantees only that governments whose countries are enmeshed in global supply chains will have to think three times, not just twice, about engaging in anything but a war of self-defense. And if they choose to go to war anyway, the price they will pay will be 10 times higher than it was a decade ago, and probably 10 times higher than whatever the leaders of that country think. It is one thing to lose your McDonald's. It is quite another to fight a war that costs you your place in a 21st century supply chain that may not come back around for a long time.
Infosys versus Al-Qaeda. Alas, a new source for geopolitical instability has emerged only in recent years, for which even the updated Dell theory can provide no restraint. It is the emergence of mutant global supply chains. That is, non-state actors, be they criminals or terrorists, who learn to use all the elements of the flat world to advance a highly destabilizing, even nihilistic agenda. I first started thinking about this when Nandan Nilekani, the Infosys CEO, was giving me that tour I referred to in Chapter 1 of his company's global video conferencing center at its Bangalore headquarters. As Nandan explained to me how Infosys could get its global supply chain together at once for a virtual conference in that room, a thought popped into my head. Who else uses open sourcing and supply chaining so imaginatively? The answer, of course, is Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has learned to use many of the same instruments for global collaboration that Infosys uses, but instead of producing products and profits with them, it has produced mayhem and murder. This is a particularly difficult problem. In fact, it may be the most vexing geopolitical problem for flat world countries that want to focus on the future. The flat world, unfortunately, is a friend of both Infosys and Al-Qaeda. The Dell theory will not work at all against these informal Islamo-Leninist terror networks because they are not a state with a population that will hold its leaders accountable or with a domestic business lobby that might restrain them. These mutant global supply chains are formed for the purpose of destruction, not profit. They don't need investors, only recruits, donors, and victims. Yet these mobile, self-financing mutant supply chains use all the tools of collaboration offered by the flat world, open sourcing to raise money, to recruit followers, and to stimulate and disseminate ideas, outsourcing to train recruits, and supply chaining to distribute the tools and the suicide bombers to undertake operations. The U.S. Central Command has a name for this whole underground network: the Virtual Caliphate. And its leaders and innovators understand the flat world almost as well as Walmart, Dell, and Infosys do. I tried to explain that you cannot understand the rise of Al-Qaeda emotionally and politically without reference to the flattening of the world. What I am arguing here is that you cannot understand the rise of Al-Qaeda technically without reference to the flattening of the world either. Globalization in general has been Al-Qaeda's friend in that it has helped to solidify a revival of Muslim identity and solidarity, with Muslims in one country much better able to see and sympathize with the struggles of their brethren in another country, thanks to the internet and satellite television. The flattening of the world has also led to more urbanization and large-scale immigration to the West of many of these young, unemployed, frustrated Arab Muslim males, while simultaneously making it much easier for informal open-source networks of these young men to form, operate, and interconnect. This certainly has been a boon for underground extremist Muslim political groups. There has been a proliferation of these informal mutual supply chains throughout the Arab Muslim world today. Small networks of people who move money through hawalas, hand-to-hand financing networks, who recruit through alternative education systems like the madrasas, and who communicate through the internet and other tools of the global information revolution. What we have witnessed in Iraq is an even more perverse mutation of this mutant supply chain, the suicide supply chain. Since the start of the U.S. invasion in March 2002, more than 200 suicide bombers have been recruited from within Iraq and from across the Muslim world, brought to the Iraqi front by some underground railroad, connected with the bomb makers there, and then dispatched against U.S. and Iraqi targets according to whatever suits the daily tactical needs of the insurgent Islamist forces in Iraq. I can understand, but not accept, the notion that more than 37 years of Israeli occupation of the West Bank might have driven some Palestinians into a suicidal rage. But the American occupation of Iraq was only a few months old before it started to get hit by this suicide supply chain. How do you recruit so many young men off the shelf who are ready to commit suicide in the cause of jihad, many of them apparently not even Iraqis? And they don't even identify themselves by name or want to get credit, at least in this world. The fact is that Western intelligence agencies have no clue how this underground suicide supply chain, which seems to have an infinite pool of recruits to draw on, works. And yet, it has basically stymied the U.S. armed forces in Iraq. Just as you take an item off the shelf in a discount store in Birmingham and another one is immediately made in Beijing, so the retailers of suicide deploy a human bomber in Baghdad and another one is immediately recruited and indoctrinated in Beirut. To the extent that this tactic spreads, it will require a major rethinking of U.S. military doctrine. The flat world has also been such a huge boon for Al-Qaeda and its ilk because of the way it enables the small to act big and the way it enables small acts, the killing of just a few people, to have big effects. The horrific video of the beheading of Wall Street Journal reporter Danny Pearl by Islamist militants in Pakistan was transmitted by the internet all over the world. There is not a journalist anywhere who saw or even just read about that who was not terrified. But those same beheading videos are also used as tools of recruitment. The flat world makes it much easier for terrorists to transmit their terror. With the internet, they don't even have to go through Western or Arab news organizations, but can broadcast right into your computer. It takes much less dynamite to transmit so much more anxiety. Just as the U.S. Army had embedded journalists, so the suicide supply chain has embedded terrorists in their own way to tell us their side of the story. How many times have I gotten up in the morning, fired up the internet, and been confronted by the video image of some masked gunman threatening to behead an American, all brought to me courtesy of AOL's homepage? The internet is an enormously useful tool for the dissemination of propaganda, conspiracy theories, and plain old untruths, because it combines a huge reach with the patina of technology that makes anything on the internet somehow more believable. How many times have you heard someone say, "But I read it on the internet," as if that should end the argument? In fact, the internet can make things worse. It often leads to more people being exposed to crazy conspiracy theories. In the flat world, it is much more difficult to hide, but much easier to get connected. "Think of Mao at the beginning of the Chinese Communist Revolution," remarked Michael Mandelbaum, the Johns Hopkins foreign policy specialist. "The Chinese communists had to hide in caves in northwest China, but they could move around in whatever territory they were able to control. Bin Laden, by contrast, can't show his face, but he can reach every household in the world thanks to the internet. Bin Laden cannot capture any territory, but he can capture the imagination of millions of people. And he has, broadcasting right into American living rooms on the eve of the 2004 presidential election. Hell hath no fury like a terrorist with a satellite dish and an interactive website." 11-9 versus 9-11. Reflecting on this past decade and a half, during which the world went flat, it strikes me that our lives have been powerfully shaped by two dates, 11-9 and 9-11. These two dates represent the two competing forms of imagination at work in the world today. The creative imagination of 11-9 and the destructive imagination of 9-11. One brought down a wall and opened the windows of the world, both the operating system and the kind we look through. It unlocked half the planet and made the citizens there our potential partners and competitors. Another brought down the World Trade Center, closing its windows on the world restaurant forever and putting up new, invisible, and concrete walls among people at a time when we thought 11-9 had erased them for good. The dismantling of the Berlin Wall on 11-9 was brought about by people who dared to imagine a different, more open world, one where every human being would be free to realize his or her full potential, and who then summoned the courage to act on that imagination. Imagine. Imagine if East German citizens, young and old, men and women, were so emboldened by seeing their neighbors flee to the West that one day they just swarmed that Berlin Wall and started to tear it down. Some people must have had a conversation just like that, and because they did, millions of Eastern Europeans were able to walk out from behind the Iron Curtain and engage with a flattening world. It was a great era in which to be an American. We were the only superpower, and the world was our oyster. There were no walls. Young Americans could think about traveling for a semester or a summer to more countries than any American generation before them. Indeed, they could travel as far as their imagination and wallets could take them. They could also look around at their classmates and see people from more different countries and cultures than any other class before them. 9/11, of course, changed all that. It showed us the power of a very different kind of imagination. It showed us the power of a group of hateful men who spent several years imagining how to kill as many innocent people as they could. At some point, Bin Laden and his gang literally must have looked at one another and said, "Imagine if we actually could hit both towers of the World Trade Center at the exact right spot, between the 94th and 98th floors. And imagine if each tower were to come crashing down like a house of cards." Yes, I am sorry to say, some people had that conversation too. And as a result, the world that was our oyster seemed to close up like a shell. There has never been a time in history when the character of human imagination wasn't important. But writing this book tells me that it has never been more important than now. Because in a flat world, so many of the inputs and tools of collaboration are becoming commodities available to everyone. They are all out there for anyone to grasp. There is one thing, though, that has not and can never be commoditized, and that is imagination. When we lived in a more centralized and more vertically organized world, where states had a near total monopoly of power, individual imagination was a big problem when the leader of a superpower state, a Stalin, a Mao, or a Hitler, became warped. But today, when individuals can easily access all the tools of collaboration and superempower themselves or their small cells, individuals do not need to control a country to threaten large numbers of other people. The small can act very big today and pose a serious danger to world order without the instruments of a state. Therefore, thinking about how we stimulate positive imaginations is of the utmost importance. As Irving Vladowski Berger, the IBM computer scientist, put it to me, we need to think more seriously than ever about how we encourage people to focus on productive outcomes that advance and unite civilization. Peaceful imaginations that seek to minimize alienation and celebrate interdependence rather than self-sufficiency. Inclusion rather than exclusion. Openness, opportunity, and hope rather than limits, suspicion, and grievance. I could not agree more. Indeed, that effort may be the most important thing we learn to do in order to keep this planet in one piece. My own daughter went off to college in the fall of 2004, and my wife and I dropped her off on a warm September day. The sun was shining. Our daughter was full of excitement. But I can honestly say it was one of the saddest days of my life. And it wasn't just the dad and mom dropping their eldest child off at school thing. No, something else bothered me. It was the sense that I was dropping my daughter off into a world that was so much more dangerous than the one she had been born into. I felt like I could still promise my daughter her bedroom back, but I couldn't promise her the world. Not in the carefree way that I had explored it when I was her age. That really bothered me. Still does. The flattening of the world has presented us with new opportunities, new challenges, new partners, but also, alas, new dangers, particularly as Americans. It is imperative that we find the right balance among all of these. It is imperative that we be the best global citizens that we can be, because in a flat world, if you don't visit a bad neighborhood, it might visit you. And it is imperative that while we remain vigilant to the new threats, we do not let them paralyze us. I refuse to settle for a world that gets smaller in the wrong sense, in the sense that there are fewer and fewer places an American can go without a second thought and fewer foreigners feeling comfortable about coming to America. To put it another way, the greatest dangers we Americans face are an excess of protectionism, excessive fears of another 9/11 that prompt us to wall ourselves in search of personal security, and excessive fears of competing in a world of 11/9 that prompts us to wall ourselves off in search of economic security.
Either one would be a disaster for us and for the world. Yes, I have said a lot about how economic competition in the flat world will be more intense and involve more players. We Americans will have to work harder, run faster, and become smarter to make sure that more of us are able to connect and compete, collaborate, and innovate on the flat world platform, and derive all the benefits it has to offer. But remember, the most important competition is now with yourself, making sure that you are always striving to get the most out of your own imagination and then acting on it. I can't tell any other society or culture what to say to its own children, but I can tell you what I say to my own. The world is being flattened. I didn't start it, and you can't stop it, except at a great cost to human development and your own future. But we can tilt it and shape it for better or for worse. If it is to be for better, not for worse, then you and your generation must not live in fear of either the terrorists or tomorrow, of either Al-Qaeda or Infosys.
You can flourish in this flat world, but it does take the right imagination and the right motivation. While your lives have been powerfully shaped by 9/11, the world needs you to be forever the generation of 11/9. The generation of strategic optimists, the generation with more dreams than memories, the generation that wakes up each morning and not only imagines that things can be better, but also acts on that imagination every day.
We hope you've enjoyed The World is Flat, an audio renaissance audiobook from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This program was produced by Paul Rubin. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2005 by Thomas L. Friedman. Production copyright 2005 by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtzbrinck Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.